extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle is here. Big show coming up, match day 16 in the books. Memorial Day weekend, meaning we're here on Tuesday for you, leading into midweek MLS on Wednesday. So, yeah, no rest for the weary. We'll hit you with the best thing we saw from match day 16. Shaqiri, did we see him? Did we not see him? Why is it the best thing? Doyle will tell you. Plus, we all saw Ricky Pooj's hair and his proclamation that good things are coming. So we'll explain that in just a second. Our man of the match day comes from FC Cincinnati. Who it is, you'll have to wait to find out. But Toronto almost nicked the points per game leaders in Major League Soccer. Plus, we'll dig into that shield race, who alarm bells should be ringing for below the playoff line, and make a big round around the league with 2-3-3 draws and some other interesting results throughout MLS. And take a look at match day 17. Doyle, what's up, man?
I'm still wrapping my head around Ricky Pooj's hair. That was just spectacular.
Let's just start there. The best thing I saw is Ricky Pooj going full Catalan Ken. It was brassy. It was not an ideal dye job. It was not something that you're going to see in a fashion magazine. It was just a little bit off, Doyle. It wasn't quite right, but it was beautiful all the same. And Ricky embraced it. He went and did the Dragon Ball Z celebration. He shot some fireballs out or whatever it is. Anders, help me out. He went Super Saiyan, something like that. I love that Ricky has these thoughts and he doesn't just have the thoughts like, oh, I should dye my hair. He just goes and does it, and it seems like he goes and does it by going to the grocery store and buying a box and just being like, whatever it comes out as, it comes out as. Like, that's definitely – that was not – and look, if it was and you're listening, professional hairdresser somewhere, that seemed like an amateur job to me.
Yeah. I mean, that looked like an amateur job to me. And in high school, I was a theater kid, and I would dye my hair, you know, using the Manic Panic,
as one does.
As one does. And I'll tell you, that's what Ricky looked like on the field. And then, of course, he scores a banger, and he was awesome, and the Galaxy,
and then also gets into it with Ben Olsen at the end, which was even more absurd. But to go to my previous point in the intro, he hinted afterwards that good news is coming, and we've been hearing rumblings about a Ricky Pooj contract extension for a mighty long time. So it feels like the Galaxy might have just locked down their man.
And he dyed his hair to celebrate.
I think he probably needs to. Look, he's making enough if he signed that extension, or if he didn't, he should probably just go to somebody who can fix that during the week. But maybe there was no time before Wednesday. What's the best thing you saw?
The Chicago Fire kind of bidding adieu to Jordan Shaqiri. Like, for those who don't know, there is a reporting date for players who are part of the Euros and the Copa America. And the date was Monday, yesterday, as we're recording this. Chicago let Shaqiri go, joined Switzerland 3 days earlier. They're like, no, actually, we don't need you, or maybe even want you for our game this week. And I couldn't imagine another team in MLS letting their highest paid player, their DP number 10, go before what is ultimately a kind of a crucial game given where we are in the season. But Shaqiri's been so poor that the Fire just kind of punted. And then afterwards, Frank Lopez gave some quotes that were, I mean, you don't need to have a degree in linguistics to read between the lines here. I'll read you the quotes. You asked me in the press conference, and I didn't know it at the time. It was a last-second decision, and I think it's just normal. My editorial note is, no, it's not.
This is the decision, of course, to let Shaqiri go early before the international break actually arrives.
Right. So back to what Klopas was saying, I think at the point where we are at the moment as a group, I think we needed, and I needed, everyone to be focusing on one thing, and it's just normal. A lot of normalcy. It's human, you know, from a human standpoint, that the guy could be thinking of the Euros. It could be his last one of his career. So I think it's best that we made that decision, and we wish him the best. I felt the team, for me, you saw it. I felt it was very important, first of all, to come out with good intensity, with energy, commitment from everyone to understand what it's going to take to get a result and get ourselves out of there. We had that tonight. We had passion and we were together for 90 minutes. And there was a huge belief all the way to the end from the guys. You saw it. They left it on the field, and regardless of what happened, this is the kind of team and the effort and the mentality that myself, that everyone expects when you put on that Chicago Fire jersey. And if we do that, regardless of the outcome, it's a team that we can all be proud of. It's hard to read that and not feel like he was directly commenting on the level of effort and intensity that we've all seen from Jordan Shaqiri over the past 2 years, given where we are in the season. And Shaqiri is going to be gone for about a month for the Euros. The Euros do end before the July transfer window reopens on July 18th, but Brian Gutierrez came in, played as number 10 in this one. I thought he was very good. He's been better than Shaqiri over the past couple of years. It feels like there's a non-zero. And Shaqiri, by the way, he's out of contract at the end of this year. It feels like there's a non-zero chance we've seen his last performance for the Chicago Fire. Do you read that the same way?
I think non-zero is the best way to put it. You know, do I have any inside information? No. Does the fact that he's out of contract seem to be sort of a smoking gun anyway for the future? Oh, absolutely, yes. There's no way the Chicago Fire are going to bring back Shaqiri. So if he's already over there, why not stay?
Yeah.
Why not stay? Yeah. Is it working for Shaqiri? No, not really. Is it working for the Chicago Fire? Not at all. Yeah, whatever it is. I don't know if it's like a, the rules, there could be another contract buyout, for instance, and you'd be buying out half a year. Or you could say, hey, we own a team in Switzerland. Go play for Lugano. Kasper Schabilko before you has trodden this path. You may also go to Lugano.
Ignacio Aliseda is still there, is he not?
Exactly. And he thrived, Shaq. He thrived. You can too. It just feels like from the start, this partnership never gelled. It never worked. And I can't say that you can blame Jordan Shaqiri alone for that. And I think that's important context. And that this is a organizational failure.
Yeah.
Whether it's with the scouting and the signing or the environment when he arrived or the teammates or the coaching carousel that's gone on, this is not a Shaqiri problem. He is part of the problem in Chicago. But this is a Chicago Fire problem.
But this is the thing. Shaqiri was supposed to be so good that he would fix the problems, because this is something that we've seen with, young South American players, more established players from Europe, guys who have come in from a Big Five league, guys who have come in from a smaller league trying to work their way to a Big Five league. All across the board, Chicago has had failure after failure with their designated player signings for years. And when they got Shaqiri, he was at the tail end of his prime. He's obviously a very established player. I think he's still a high quality player. And he was supposed to be so good that it smoothed the sort of arrival period for the other players, especially in attack. Because when you have a number 10 who can sort of run the whole ship, it just makes it so much easier for every other player. And Shaqiri never came close to being that guy. And throughout, though, to get back to Klopas's statements, throughout his lack of intensity and the lack of buy-in, I think was really galling to Fire fans. And if there's a reason to think maybe he's not going to come back, or maybe even be welcomed back, it's that, Klopas was right. The team, they played, they were humming at a different frequency this weekend. It wasn't great. They got a 1-1 draw and they were the second best team on the field, but there was a sort of willingness to suffer and do the hard stuff that has been lacking a lot of the time over the past 15 years, but especially over the past two.
I mean, I get it, but the other 10 guys on the field are supposed to suffer and do the hard stuff when you sign Jordan Shaqiri. You did not sign him expecting him to be...
Yeah, but how many times do you see across sports, it's like, oh, your best player is doing that, then what a tone that sets. And that's the whole thing that we're seeing in Toronto.
I was just going to bring Toronto up. I was going to say the guys in Toronto last year could have the same exact commentary of like not bought in, not putting the effort in, 1 foot out, 1 foot in. At least Shaqiri wasn't walking around being like, can I go back to Juventus? That would be the best possible thing for me. This entire thing was a mistake. I mean, I think about Lucho in Cincinnati, and this goes back to the organizational side. He suffered through misery in year one in Cincinnati, and it wasn't like he was a bad player. Clearly, he's a potentially transformational player. But when your organization is so sick that nothing is there in terms of foundation around that star player, which I think you can point directly at the Chicago Fire and say that, what do you expect? And if Shaqiri's not a guy who's been the dude who elevated everybody else previously in his career outside of Switzerland, I think you can say he did that frequently for his country, then why would you expect that to be the case here? I mean, even Benteke, when he arrived before this year, he's been very good. Has he been able to elevate DC out of the muck and the mire? In large part, no. Yeah, I don't know. I go back to like what is going to stay the same when Shaqiri leaves, whenever that is, whether it's the summer or the end of the year, and it's going to be the Chicago Fire as an organization have big time issues that they have to work out if they want to make progress from what is basically, I mean, when you just say the bottom?
Yeah.
Based on the last decade plus?
This is, and I think this is arguably the worst Fire team that we've seen so far from this, you know, decade and a half of futility. And you're right, Shaqiri shouldn't be held entirely accountable. And to that end, a lot of the stuff we just said about effort and intensity and buy-in and willingness to suffer, you could say about Gaston Jimenez as well. And he's still a DP. And he's been a DP on this roster for, what, 4 years now? And he is under contract through 2025. So that front office just keeps digging and digging and digging. Good result for the Fire, but a lot of writing on the wall about personnel moves to come, given what we saw from them this weekend and the early departure of Jordan Shaqiri.
And what's so frustrating to me, we'll just put a bow on it here, is that it's clear Joe Mansueto wants to win. It's clear that he will spend a significant amount of money to try to win. And Chicago is a club. And, you know, people, oh, it's a market. Now, for me, it's a club. This is a club in MLS that had the ultimate standard when they entered the league.
Yep.
And have just so completely lost it and lost their way that it's hard to imagine how they get back to not that standard, but just like playoff team, perennial playoff team. Like we finish third through ninth every year. And, you know, we do that because we're Chicago Fire and we'll spend more money than you. And that's not there. So sorry, Fire fans. Sorry to pile on you here early in the show. All right, let's go to our man of the match day. Luca Orsano, the wingback in Cincinnati, a 4-3 win for the Fighting Garys in Toronto, late goal. Sergio Santos popping up to get a goal and assist in this one. And Lucho waited until late on to make his mark. And of course he did it, but Orsano was the star. And we've been waiting for Orsano to have this sort of moment. The moment that they got from Alvaro Barreal a handful of times last year was just like, hey, that dude's the best player in the game. And he's a wing back. The interesting thing for me, before we get into the nitty gritty of the match itself, Doyle, is that this came with swapping Orsano to the right side. He's mostly played on the left, direct replacement for Barreal. He is left footed. So it sort of makes sense. You're like, okay, we'll play on the left, but that doesn't allow him to do the things that previous in his career he did the best, which was cutting inside on that left foot into a more central position. And those are all the spaces we saw him thrive in this game against Toronto.
Yeah, I mean, just first things first, if you had asked me what the main tactical tweak we were going to see in MLS this year was going to be, inverted wingbacks would have been nowhere on my bingo card. Like last year, even Wilfred Nancy, as progressive as he is, he had his left footer playing on the left side and he had his right footer playing on the right side. And those guys got real high and they were more wingers than wingbacks, but they weren't playing inverted. And, you know, between what John Herdman's done in Toronto and now Pat Noonan trying it out with Orsano and in Cincinnati and a few other places, we're seeing it as well. It's added a tactical wrinkle that I've appreciated this season. Ariana was great. And part of it is that Cincinnati have invested so much defensively, they can take real risks with where they position their wingbacks, both in terms of which side they're on and their starting positions. And I actually think that Orejano is playing higher than Barrial did last year on that left side. They scored four goals in this game. They didn't score four goals in a game once last year. They scored seven goals over two games. That's something that they did not do at all last year. Now, granted, it was another one-goal win. They have 23 one-goal wins over the past two seasons. But this one felt a lot different because it was just like, yeah, we're struggling a little bit defensively. We have so much firepower, we can outscore you. And that's not something that we had seen from Cincinnati at all this year. It's not something we really saw from them much last year, other than like there were a few moments when Vasquez and Pupenza had it going. We saw it in this one. Orejano is a big reason why. He did swap back to the left side as well, and we saw some of that combo play between him and Lucho. Kevin Kelsey has come in and been Brandon Vasquez, just left-footed. It's been awesome to see, and they're in seven wins in a row now. It's tied for the second longest winning streak in post-shootout MLS history. The record is 9, which the Sounders set back in 2018. They are hosting Nashville on Wednesday night. They're strong favorites to win that game. There's nobody on 8. They would be second all alone if they push it to 8. And like with the way they're playing, a 4-0 would not shock me. But also, we know they have the ability to win a 2-1 because they've been as good at that over the past couple of years as anybody in league history.
You mentioned 23 wins, one goal wins since the start of 2023. I just to put context to that, 4 losses in those same one goal
not bad, decisions. Right?
23-4 in those decisions. And you know, this year I think there's I'm curious to get your take on this. My take on Cincinnati in 2024 is actually, though we haven't seen it just yet, but we're starting to, their ceiling is a good bit higher this year than it was last year.
I agree with that. I agree
because
with that.
I think it's a more mature team. Miles Robinson didn't have his best game, granted, but Miles Robinson versus Yerson Mosquera. And Yerson Mosquera's talent is through the freaking roof. This dude is, he's off to Spain and already balling, right? But like the experience level, the complementary nature that he has with Miazga, the additional communicator, which was not one of Mosquera's strengths, which understandably so. The guy's he's a Spanish speaker in a backline of mostly English speakers, and he's trying to adapt to a new country. DeAndre Yedlin on the right, who we haven't seen yet. The reason why Orshano has been on the left is because you have a tried and true, this guy gets it, this guy knows every single level where you're at right now, how to thrive sort of player, and is a leader. Boucher into the team. Lucho taking another step forward. Ideally a replacement for Pupenza in the summer. I had a chat with Pat Noonan this last week, and he was like, I can't tell you any details, but if you were in the room, you would understand how much ambition we have as a club. And yeah, I freaking believe him based on what they've done since Chris Albright arrived. Like, I just think that this team is killing people, 7 straight wins, and not even the performances. If you compare performance to result, the performances are just starting to reach the level where you're like, oh yeah, that points per game makes sense.
Yep.
They were just grinding people down before. Imagine if they can grind you down and they can outscore you.
I think we're hitting that point. And I think that it has a chance to elevate even further depending on what happens with Pupenza. Either he comes back in probably another month, or more likely from everything I think we're all hearing is there's some sort of mutual parting of the ways, which then opens up a DP slot. And I think they'll probably figure out a more permanent replacement at that position. In the meantime, the flexibility they've now sort of developed with having Orejano being able to play either side. Boucher is, I think, a better player than Junior Moreno, even though he didn't necessarily fit perfectly immediately. Yuya Kubo, as an S-tier sort of utility man all over the place. But also, getting these guys a couple of months of playing together. There's just more chemistry with and without the ball than they had, in March and April, right? Like they changed over five starters from a 70-point team. There was always going to be some rough spots, and it speaks to the level of talent in defense, the improvement from Roman Celentano, that they were able to grind teams down the way they did. And oh yeah, Lucho still being an MVP caliber player, getting them those crucial one goal wins so many times. And now it's just like they have an embarrassment of attacking riches, or close to it anyway. And it's going to get better, and they're not going to have to grind you down. And it does feel like the ceiling, ceiling was really high last year. The ceiling, I think, is going to end up being higher this year. And to the point where, remember what the Crew did in the Eastern Conference final, where they brought on one extra attacker and Cincinnati were suddenly overwhelmed. There was just too much to keep track of, even for the best defensive team in the league last year. It was just too much. I think Cincinnati didn't have the ability to do that to someone else last year. Now, going into the playoffs this year, they're going to have the ability to do that, to just throw out so much attacking firepower that the opponent has, like, you just throw up your hands because you know you're giving up too.
The other thing I would say about the attacking firepower and just the depth overall, because that's what it takes to win a Supporters Shield. It's what it takes to go to MLS Cup and win as well, because I would argue that depth is the reason why Cincinnati didn't win. It was not that maybe an issue with their depth, but it was injuries and absences headed into that Eastern Conference final. They were not complete in any way on the back line.
Yeah,
heading into that game. Me and Matt Miazga, and they didn't have any replacements up and down. So I just look at this roster, and when I think depth, I'm thinking a Sergio Santos who comes off the bench, who has sort of been a forgotten man, but was a big acquisition early on for this front office. Okay, goal and assist. Those are the type of performances you need over. Brett Halsey can play both sides, both wingbacks. Okay, cool. That fits with Orellano in this game, because Toronto FC did a good job taking away Lucho in a lot of ways. I mean, John Herdman has the quote-unquote Acosta rules. He called the man Neo in the Matrix. He took the blue pill or the red pill or whichever one helped him limit Acosta, but you know they did that for 85 minutes, but ultimately Lucho is going to pop up. But Dado Valenzuela started. You know, Ian Murphy is starting and playing well. Celentano has developed significantly since he got there. Miguel Pinto, Yamil Assad is playing big minutes. They're sitting with Haglund waiting on the bench. Like, credit to Chris Albright, to Pat Noonan, to Dom Kinnear, to Kenny Arena, to everybody involved in this staff. And if you go look at the list, it's like a who's who of who knows MLS. Credit to those guys for creating an environment where it's like, yeah, you know, against Toronto on the road, Dado Valenzuela is going to come in here and do a job. He's going to be super effective. We're going to have signings that we bring in from outside the club, like Alvaro Barrial or Brenner, thrive and move on. We're going to have homegrowns start to come through our system and be difference makers in first team games. And we're going to get mostly the most out of our big signings like Wobodo and Lucho and Boucher and Miazga and all these other guys. Now, Bupenza is the lone issue with that right now, but to go to development, Brandon Vasquez. Now, what Cincinnati are doing, what they're representing, to me is way more impressive in this moment than what it represented when they pulled out of their death spiral. Like, a lot of teams are bad, then become respectable in MLS. That's part of this parity that we work with. What's much harder is to go from historically bad to respectable to elite and then stay there and find another level. That is so difficult. And what they're doing right now and doing sort of like ho-hum, humbly behind the scenes is super impressive. We'll get to the Shield race in a second. Let's just tie this off with Toronto. They almost did it, Doyle. For all this praise for FC Cincinnati, they almost did it without Fede, without Bernadeschi, who was out and stupidly so, but we could get to that another day. That yellow card he got late on in the Canadian Classic was a bummer. But Insigne was offside by a hair, almost had the game-tying goal, was an absolute menace this entire match. Are Toronto, in your mind, a contender? This is an extension of a wrap-up conversation we had, where you had to say pretender or contender. Which way would you go?
They're pretenders for the Shield. They're not going to win the Supporter Shield.
How about not Shield? We're not saying Shield. I'm saying MLS Cup.
Pretenders right now. I think they're, and I know this game they showed well, but I think there's a level or two between them and Cincy, Miami, Columbus, maybe a fully formed LAFC, maybe an improved RSL as well, because RSL, don't forget, have the ability to go out and add a DP number 10 this summer. I don't know if Toronto's going to do that. They haven't made any big signings since Insigne and Bernardeschi, and I like this team a lot, but it just feels they're a level below. They could make a run. You know, I could see them making Eastern Conference Finals. I could see them making a run in the League's Cup. They're a tough team to play. That's pretty clear. And John Herdman has been so much fun tactically. But they also, they leave central midfield kind of barren. You can win second balls against them and go. They push those wing backs really high. And they don't have the defensive structure behind them, really just the personnel quality that teams like Cincinnati or even Columbus do. You actually made the point, which is a good one. You feel like Long is the Kevin Long is their sort of secret weapon on that back line.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he's just an aerial dominant force back there, and he's been hurt for the last three or so games, and that's when a lot of the goals have bubbled up on them. And oh, by the way, they also got in a fight in New York and had a ton of guys suspended, so they've been going through a little bit of a roster shuffle as well. I agree with you. I threw up contender on the show because somebody's got to fight against BWP and Sasha at some point. The reason I said contender was just simply because we haven't really seen Insigne and Bernardeschi at the same time with runway to build form together. And we haven't seen Richie Larea yet. And ostensibly, those are their best players, them and Jonathan Osorio, who's also been out. So we haven't seen the best. I have the same concerns about the backline of midfield that you do.
Yeah.
Same exact ones. And I don't think this team has a ton of flexibility to go out and make big changes. But credit to Jason Hernandez. With the little flexibility he had this offseason, he went out and got guys like Long, like Gomis, like Davy Flores, like Longstaff. And the theme is pretty clear. It's guys that were sort of on hard luck in their careers or were in a place where they weren't getting the time or the opportunity that they wanted and were at a crossroads. And those are the perfect players to stick in a locker room with John Herdman as he's trying to rebuild this product and say, if you have one thing we need from you, it's just belief. Come in here with a positive mindset. That's all we're trying to foster. Everybody has ownership. Everybody believes. Let's see how far we go. And right now, where they could go, I think, is pretty high, given the top-end talent that they have. Where they could end up is also on the lower side as well, because the bottom could fall out.
I will say, I agree, I think, across the board with that. I'm not sure their top-end talent is equal to the top-end talent in Cincinnati, in Columbus, obviously in Miami. Bernardeschi and Insigne are great individual players, and Bernardeschi has shown a willingness to play as a two-way player this year that is really impressive. He's not the sort of creative engine who makes everyone in the attack 20, 30% better the way Lucho does. Obviously, the way Messi makes everybody 75% better. And then Insigne is spectacular in moments, but he's never, you know, not even at his apex for Napoli, he's never been a guy who runs the show. He's not that type of player. So I think they miss that sort of connecting piece, number 10. You know, Jonathan Osorio can sort of moonlight in that role a little bit, but he's not a guy who's passing, like, he's more of a combiner rather than a pure chance creator. So I think that the top-end talent individually is very good, but it's not the type of top-end talent that elevates the play of everybody around them. And I think that is something, as much as, you know, tactical issues or defensive issues, that is something else that I think separates them from the very best teams in the league.
And I can see that so very clearly, and I would apply that to Supporters Shield contender status. I'm not sure I would apply it to MLS Cup contender status, because depending on your draw and your form and your health and the health and form of others going into that, if you win a three-game series and you go and you start knocking teams off in one game because Insigne hits that right-footed curler that he's known for and Bernardeschi takes the game over, you got a chance. That's a long way away, though. Also a long way away, Opie Dope hit us up, Chop Cheese 93. That's an incredible combination of Twitter username and tag says between Cincinnati, Miami, and Fort Lauderdale in late August and Cincinnati, LAFC, and Cincy in September, which match is going to be more exciting to watch? That's an easy one. He's trying to sell me on Miazga going up against Giroux, but come on, it's Lucho against Messi. It's the all-star team that is Inter Miami against what we think will be a Shield contender at that same time in Cincinnati. What a wonderful game that will be. As it stands right now, Miami have 34 points from 16 matches. Cincinnati have 33 from 15, so Cincy at 2.2 points per game is leading Miami, trailing 4 points behind Cincy and 5 behind Miami as RSL. And we won't include them, I don't think, in this Supporter Shield race for the time being, Doyle, because they haven't lost in 11 games and they still have a 4-point gap between these other two. Who is the prohibitive favorite for you right now between Miami and Cincy for the Shield?
I don't think either is the prohibitive favorite. If Nicolas Freire hadn't done his ACL, I would have said Miami, but I think he was their best defender by a pretty decent margin so far this season. And certainly his distribution from the back was better than they've gotten from Aviles or Christoph. And that distribution from the back was what got Miami into sort of patterns of play without Busquets having to drop deep into the middle of the back line. And when Busquets drops deep, he's fantastic, but it also opens up a pretty big gap, just like a physical distance between the back line and the midfield. And that is where counterattacks are born. And for a mostly old team, you don't want to be giving up counterattacks. So I think the chain reaction of losing Freire has brought Miami back to the pack a little bit, to the point where I don't think there's a prohibitive favorite between them and Cincinnati. I'm still picking Miami, but it's not by a lot.
Interestingly, right now, you know, both these teams are on close to historic paces, basically. I mean, the record all time, I think, is still 2.15 points per game. I believe the Revs still hold that on 73 points. Is your memory
correct?
Match that up. Yeah. So right now you would have Miami just behind that pace and Cincinnati just above it. And historically, that pace has been about one thing in particular, and that is spectacular home form. There is not a Shield winner going back to, there's one. New England actually dropped points 5 times at home, but were so good on the road that they managed to rack it up. But every other Shield winner of the past 5 or 6
years.
Can I just interrupt?
And remember that New England team played a sort of a modified schedule in 2021. That was the second COVID year where there wasn't as much travel. Like they ended up playing in Philadelphia, I think 4 times during the season. Like Bruce Arena joked about it after winning the Shield. So being a team that wins the Shield via their road record is an outlier born of a schedule, which was an outlier born of a global pandemic that, you know, is not taking a role in how games are played out today. Sorry to interrupt.
No, and that's the context you can only get on Extra Time, folks. I can say that with complete confidence. Both these teams right now are very good home teams, but both have already dropped points 3 times at home in 7 and 8 games respectively, but both are doing the same exact thing on the road. So that's something to watch here. Ultimately, home games are going to be what win you the Shield. That's just historic truth. So every home game these teams play, keep a close eye on it. Every drop point is going to matter over the course of the season. Miami at home on Wednesday night against Atlanta, Cincinnati at home against Nashville. Big ones there. But there are some epic races going back through the last couple of years. 2022 was a good race. Of course, LAFC won that on tiebreaker against the Philadelphia Union. Red Bulls in 18, just barely pipping by 2 points. Atlanta United, that went down to the final day, if I remember correctly. And then in 16, it was like a down year. Dallas won it, but there was like 4 or 5 teams all in it. And I just hope for one thing in 2024, and that is for Miami and Cincinnati to hold steady and to get those points so we can get an epic race down the line. Now, Miami did their job in Vancouver, Doyle. Iniesta. I mean, this dude, no Messi, so Robert Taylor's just like, I'll cosplay Messi today, guys. Let me cut in. Let me curl bangers. Let me be the assist man. It's amazing. It's amazing the depth and quality this team has.
You know what it looked like? It looked like one of those patented Nacho Piatti goals. Remember, like for 4 or 5 years straight, Piatti would overperform his underlying numbers because he had this one move where he was able to cut in, you know, from the left wing, get the ball onto his right foot, and then pick out the back. He would score that goal six times a year, and that would account for his entire overperformance. Robert Taylor did that, and it was awesome. And, you know, they got a second goal, and they just had enough at that point to ride it out and get a 2-1 win 3,000 miles from home. And this is the stuff that Supporter Shield wins are made of. I thought Jordi Alba was awesome. Yannick Bright, like, he is what, the 20th pick in the super draft, and everybody knew he was very, very good, probably considered a top five talent. But he, requires an international roster slot. You know, Chris Henderson, his ability to understand and work within these rules to get the little bit of extra gam that you needed to trade to acquire an extra international roster slot. So suddenly you have a plug-and-play rookie who can sub in for Sergio Busquets and also is the top backup at right back or second backup at right back as well. Finding answers all the way down the roster, it's been really impressive. It wasn't the greatest game in the world, but they didn't need to play the greatest game in the world because they had enough match winners out there and they had enough solidity from guys who other teams could have had for relative pennies. It's all like, it all builds up to what I've called repeatedly the deepest team I've ever seen in MLS. And this was a win that showed it.
Federico Redondo is back on the bench as well. Got a yellow card in this game, so he's back in form, so to speak. No, just kidding. But he will be pretty soon. But yeah, you're missing the all-star trio. And you still go to Vancouver all the way across the country and get a result against Vancouver's first-choice lineup.
Yep. First-choice. You're still missing Diego Gomez, too.
Good
one. You know, they're missing Messi, Suarez, Busquets, Gomez, who is a nailed-on starter.
Farias, who you just forgot about that guy. I mean,
and Ferre, who we just mentioned, is done for the season and was their best. It's a lot, man. It's going to take a lot to beat this team for the Shield race, in the League Cup, and in MLS Cup.
All right, we'll see what happens. Of course, Leo Messi probably going to be gone for Copa America for a while himself, so they'll have to survive without some of their biggest players and the biggest player in the league. We'll see if they can do it. How about the middle class right now, Doyle? 14 teams from 26 points to 18 points. Let's each pick two in each conference that you'd bet on to get in the top four by the end of the year. The teams that you have faith in. You believe in these teams. I'll start us in the Western Conference. LAFC. I believe in LAFC. They went to Atlanta on the weekend and got a 1-0 win. It was ugly. Was not what they're hoping to see.
But LAFC's, it was a bogus free already, kick. They're already in the top four, though.
Okay. But I'm saying they're going to stay there. They're barely there. They're barely there, Doyle. Outside the top four then? Take a chance.
I think Seattle, and maybe I'm being foolish with this, but they're 3-1-2 in their last six. The only loss was at RSL, who are a really good team, and they're staying in the top two in that Western Conference all year. The Sounders always lose in Utah. So their only loss was sort of a scheduled loss. They're better and cleaner with the ball at the back since getting Jackson Reagan and Yaimar Gomez Andrade, getting them fully healthy. Moving Christian Roldan back to the number eight alongside Joao Paulo, I think that's helped a lot. They're getting more attack from their fullbacks. Maybe Nuhu has kind of lost the starting job a little bit. I'm not sure if that's just sort of a squad rotation thing, but it's something that it feels like Brian Schmetzer is going to want to take a long look at. And their ability to use the ball like that opened up space to attack in behind the St. Louis team. Even earlier in the season, when the Sounders were, 13th, 14th place, whatever it was, they were playing so much better than what the results were. And over the past month, the results have started to match up with the performances. Now, they still need to get Pedro de la Vega healthy. I think we'll see him Wednesday night, probably for 25, 30 minutes. And he needs to be the type of guy who can unlock an opposing team, because there are going to be games where the opponent's like, you want 60% of the ball, you can have it. You could come set up shop in the attacking third. You're going to have to break down banks of four. And Seattle's problem with that last year was they didn't have anyone who could beat a dude 1v1. De La Vega can. That is why they went out and they got him. So he's going to have to be that guy. And then they're going to have to address the number nine situation. I you know, Rowley Diaz has been pretty good, but I don't think he's a lead the line forward for a title contending team at this point in his career.
He's also just not the long-term solution. It's this year.
Yep.
Right? And that's it.
His contract is done in December, and I don't think he's going to be here beyond that. He might not even be here up to that, to the end of that contract. Because if you're Adrian Hanauer and you're looking at this team saying, let's say they go, 3-1-1 over the next five games or however many there are until the summer window opens, and you're like, oh, we're an elite number nine away from winning an MLS Cup. You're probably going to say, okay, let's make the decision on Rowley Diaz and let's go shopping for that elite number nine this summer, which, remember, the Sounders have a really storied history of doing exactly that, including with Rowley Diaz.
Knew who was suspended, says Anders. We'll see what that means.
I totally missed that.
Yeah, you know what? Other than I love the argument. Other than that, as someone who picked the Sounders to win the West in preseason, it would go a long way to my credibility if they could rise up the table now. I'm going to go, outside the top four. Well, darn it. No, they're not. I was going to choose Columbus in the East, but I'm going easy so that I'll make it hard for you. I think Columbus is pretty self-explanatory. Same. Nice win this weekend. And we saw one of those vintage Wilfred Nancy Columbus Crew goals scored by Diego Rossi, who's now gotten to really good form. And please let Cucho be okay for that final coming up this weekend in Pachuca. We'll get you the full preview of the CONCACAF Champions Cup final, Pachuca versus Crew, coming up on Thursday's show. But in the meantime, go back to the East. I'm going to give you a choice to make the top four: NYCFC, Toronto, or the New York Red Bulls. Which is more likely?
Well, NYCFC is in the top four, so I think that makes them more likely.
I truly hate you.
Of those three teams, I will go out on a limb and I'll say the top four now in the East is what the top four is going to be at the end of the year. Now, I do expect Columbus and NYCFC to flip spots. Columbus will finish third behind Cincy in Miami. NYCFC will finish fourth. But I think, based upon what I've seen so far, I think these are the four best, most complete teams. And NYCFC showed to have some depth as well, with James Sands not being available. Pereira's come in and done a nice job. Matt Fries has done a nice job in goal. So they're there. The caveat is, if the Red Bulls go out and get that big time DP number nine in the summer window, they could rocket up the standings, because this is a team that is, I think, pretty close to complete. They just don't have that top end attacking talent.
If they go get this DP number nine for a team that has an open designated player spot, mm-hmm. What does that starting lineup look like? Lewis Morgan has been more effective than Dante Van Zier or anyone else as a line stretching goal scorer in the two up front. Does that then mean that Van Zier is a bench player? What does that mean to you when it comes to the lineup? Or is it now Emil Forsberg and Lewis Morgan behind a DP and Dante Van Zier?
I think that Sandra Schwartz would probably take a look at both. My question with Lewis Morgan would be, like, do they think he has the stamina and the physical ability to play both sides of the ball in the way that the wide midfielders need, who are really attacking midfielders in that system, need to? And given the number of injuries he's had over the past few years, I kind of suspect they would be more comfortable keeping him in that second forward role and asking a little bit less of him physically. And then that would, lead to other moves that they would make. I think, they've done a good job developing Vicky Carmona. Peter Stroud has played really well out there, even though he's a much different archetype of a player. Cameron Harper's given them good minutes. It's a good problem to have, and it's one the Red Bulls haven't had in a long, long time. As for Van Zier, like, he he reads to me as a type of guy who would be a super sub. And then at the end of the season, you figure out whether you want to keep him for another year or go in a different direction and open up a DP slot and try to raise the overall talent level even higher.
All right, Rebels fans, you think you're going to get that player? Let us know. Let us know what you think. Sounds like a certain German at Tottenham is going to extend his loan. So that might not be good news, but we'll see who else is available out there. Hey, alarm bells should be ringing for. We've done the elites. We've done the middle class. Let's go down to the brokies below the playoff line. Matt Johnson says the top of each conference has largely been sorted, but which team's currently below the line of the best shot at places 5, 6, and 7 in each conference? And what do they need to do to get there? Well, Matt is still living in the 7-team MLS Cup playoff format. We're now in the 9-team. So you just got to get into the 9. And I was curious. So I went back and did the math from 2021 on. Basically checked at this point in the season when teams had played from about 16 games to 13, that sort of spread, how many clubs jumped from below 9th to at or above the playoff line. And of course, in 22 and 21, those teams, if they didn't get above at or above 7th, they didn't actually make the playoffs. And it's not very many, folks. So for all the talk about, oh, it's MLS, you can wait till the summer. Hey, transfer window, make a run. Like, yeah, some teams have done that and some teams will do that, but very few will. So if you're sitting looking at your team below the playoff line right now, even if the margins are tight, odds are you're not making the playoffs. 2023, 3 teams did it. The Red Bulls, of course, were way, way down, and we saw Gerhard Struber lose his job, but the Hungry Young Wolves under Troy Lesane rose all the way up to 8th and made a little run, fell to Cincinnati. RSL actually jumped from below the line up to 5th. And then Sporting Kansas City, their story we've told ad nauseum, they jumped up to 8th and then knocked off St. Louis. So 3 teams, but that's the most in the last 3 years. In 2022, it was just Columbus and Portland both jumped up to 8th. They didn't actually make the playoffs in those years, but they would in 2024. And then in 2021, Atlanta jumped up to 5th and Vancouver jumped up to 6th. So what I'm telling you is in 3 years, 7 clubs did this. It is very unlikely that any club is going to do it this year, Doyle. Which clubs are most likely as you look over these lists? And by the way, I've armed Doyle with a handy-dandy race to 45 chart that tells you what points per game each team needs to get to what we think will be the rough cutoff line for 9th place.
I mean, just looking at these standings, it is shocking and borderline embarrassing that Atlanta are where they are. 12th place in the Eastern Conference. They would need, man, 1.6 points per game from here on out to make 45 points, which would probably almost certainly get them into the play.
They would probably sweat. They would be sweating on decision day most likely, but it would probably not certainly get them in. But they're at 0.93 right now, Joel, so they would basically have to double their output, their results the rest of the way.
And look, Gonzalo Pineda's had about 105 games in charge, and his career points per game with Atlanta across all competitions is 1.3. So we're talking 25% improvement upon his career points per game with Atlanta over the final 60% of the season. On talent, they should be the easy choice. But the way they've played, and it's not an easy choice. I can't say Nashville. I like what they've done better the past couple of weeks since going their separate ways from Gary Smith, using Hani Mukhtar as more of a true midfield number 10 rather than a second forward. I think that's helped with their ball progression, but they don't have a lot of attacking punch elsewhere. And by having 3 DPs who are true DPs, they don't have the flexibility to go out and add a big piece.
If Orlando, the rules change, you could go get a U22.
Right. And that's a big thing. They never had the ability to go get a U22 and expect to get anything out of that player because Gary Smith did not play young players. Whoever the new permanent head coach is, go ahead, Weeby. You look like you want to say
something. I'm just going to say the only team that I can see in this group below the line in the East is Orlando.
Yep.
That's the only team.
Yep. And honestly, I don't think they're playing as well as the 2 teams in front of them, which are DC and Charlotte. DC actually plays good soccer. They just do not have the horses defensively to dominate their own box in the final 15 minutes a game. With Steve Birnbaum back and healthy, maybe that changes. But overall, they're just playing better soccer than Orlando, Nashville, or Atlanta.
And Atlanta's issue here, we have a tweet from Chris Kilroy that says, you know, 3 wins in 14 matches. How can they even get back in the playoff hunt? And he mentions Olympics and Euros. I mean, Thiago Amado's about to be gone. Georgios Yakoumakis could very well be sold to Cruz Azul, who, by the way, lost the Ligia final to Club America, who went back to back. Like, this is, it's more likely that this actually gets a little bit worse than it does it gets better, in my mind.
I think you're right.
That's tough. That's tough. Well, let me ask you this. What would Pineda need to do in these two games this week? At Miami, wow, that's difficult. And home against Charlotte, who have strangled every comer in the last month out to a shutout. What would he need to get done to make the rest of the season be like, Gonzalo Pineda should for sure be the head coach of Atlanta United? Is it as simple as 2 wins? Is it 4 points?
I think
just decent performances?
I think 4 points with good performances, like not getting 4 points because, you know, somebody picked an 8th minute red card, so Miami had to play down a man the whole game, or, you know, an incredible own goal. But like, no, getting 2 results, well, a win and a draw from 2 convincing performances, I think would probably be enough, but he'd still be on the hot seat. And justifiably so. There's no reason this team should be where they are in the standings.
All right, let's go to the Western Conference. So below the, it's a little bit more packed up in the West on points than the East. The East is a little more stratified. San Jose, they have a chance?
They
need 1.79 points per game the rest of the way. 1.79, Doyle.
No, they don't. It's too much. If they had won this past weekend and they painted every inch of the woodwork, they would have had a chance, but it's too far now. They can't. This is not a 1.8 point per game team.
Kansas City would need 1.7, and the vibes are Dunsky. And also, by the way, the last 3 seasons they've been terrible to start each of those seasons. This is like becoming a trend.
Yeah, they did it last year. They had a little bit more runway than they do now. It's tough to say they can't do it because we literally saw them do it, but I would be shocked.
Dallas, 1.52 points. Portland, 1.53 points. And Seattle, 1.4 points, 4 or 5 points per game. Which of those three is most likely to jump above the 9th spot, which is currently occupied by Seattle?
Seattle, or St. Louis by far. I think that St. Louis are roughly in the right place in the standings relative to their performance and their overall talent level. They've just had a little bit of bad luck. One bounce the other way and they could be in 7th. I don't think they're much higher than that based upon their talent and the way they play. And look, man, they used 4 seasons worth of luck last year to end up on top of the Western. I still can't believe that team ended up atop the Western Conference standings. It was unreal. And it's regressed to the mean. So I think they have the best chance. I think Austin is the team that I would expect to drop out, except that Austin has now collected all of that luck that St. Louis had last year. I mean, it was absurd that they took a point from San Jose this past weekend. So it's like, those are the two teams I would keep an eye on, though. You know, a few others. Houston's not particularly convincing right now.
I was going to say, it really hurts me to say it because I love how Houston played and their season last year was magical. But Houston would be the one, in large part because of the personnel. Like, they've been starting Kowalczyk up top for how long? We'll talk a little bit in a while about big-time players that might be leaving. Seves Pereira would be one you might throw on that list as well. Hey, Cedric Teuchert, I can't say that name and we'll figure out how to say it. The German 2 Bundesliga player from Hanover who they just announced, St. Louis. We've been talking about this guy as a possibility for a long time. Just signed a 2-year contract. Where do you think he'll play? Seems like when he's at his best, it was almost like a second striker, almost like how they have Diego Rossi play in Columbus in a 3-4-2-1. How do you think he will fit into this team? Because João Klaus, to me, is pretty locked and loaded up top.
Yeah, nailed on starter. I think just playing him as that kind of like, almost like a Raumdeuter, You know, it's like, okay, you're a second forward, but sometimes you're going to drop in and play make, and sometimes you're going to go out wide and create overloads with the wide midfielders. But it'll be back to that 4-4, because they've tried a 4-2-3-1 for most of the past month and a half. And I think Indy Vasilev has had some good moments as a pressing 10, but it hasn't been their best look over the year and a half of existence in MLS. So I would expect back to the 4-2-2-2 and Toucher, or how do you say his name?
I just said I didn't know how. So
fair enough. Based upon what I've, you know, the film that I've seen of him and what the underlying numbers kind of say, that would be his best position.
All right, let's go to some wild comebacks. Dallas 3, Salt Lake 3, Dallas up 3-0 at home, swaggering about. And then by the end of it, the fans were mad. They were booing. They were throwing up certain fingers that people don't like to see. Paul Arriola reportedly was up in the DMs of some of the supporter leadership saying, what are we doing here, guys? But this was an epic collapse. No Jesus Ferreira again. Thigh injury now. He was questionable heading into the game. But RSL, man, they've got the X-Dog, and they've got quality. And they've got some real, like, interesting tactical identity going on here, Doyle. It just feels like this tried-and-true formula that they've used for years now is being leveled up, both in terms of the organizational structure around Pablo, but also in terms of the spend over the last three windows and what we expect to be more spend this summer to add to this group, particularly in the attack. How impressive is this from RSL on the road? Because any other year, I mean, literally any time in their history, this is a loss.
Yeah.
And somehow they came roaring back.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be clear, that great team from 2009 to 2013 basically never gave up three goals. So this wouldn't have been a loss. They tried to gift Dallas this game. Zach McMath had a nightmare performance, and for an hour it looked like they were going to be able to give this gift. But RSL are just a much better team than Dallas. They have so much more talent. With Diego Luna sort of shaking off the early season slump he was in, playing the way he's playing, getting numbers forward without being irresponsible positionally, which was always something that they struggled with, that's gone. Like that version of RSL is gone. It's fun to watch, and I think it speaks to what we think of them as a team. Maybe when you and I, we were in the green room watching them, and there's, you know, five other games on, and we're like, let's not turn this one off. Cause even at 3-0, this is like, we're not going to be done hearing from RSL until the final whistle blows. And that's what the story became. They're just a much better team than Dallas.
And I think we're going to see them become a better team. Talking to some folks around the club, trying to dig around to find out what could happen this summer. I mean, there is the possibility to buy down Matt Crooks. So you have the possibility to bring in another designated player, and you would think that is certainly going to be on the attacking side if they do it. Remember, this is a team that's spent $17 million over the last three transfer windows.
Yeah. And I'll have to say, because like there are going to be a lot of teams that make moves this window. The one I'm most excited for is the RSL move, because you know there's going to be one coming, and because they're very close. Matt Crook is a nice player. He is a depth piece on a championship team. They need to go out and get a Driussi or a Hani level number 10. If they get that, then I think they go into the playoffs on the same level as everybody except fully healthy Inter Miami side. It's that they're that close. Go find this generation's Javier Morales. That player's out there somewhere. They have the ability to go get it done.
Maybe get a little more depth somewhere else, and then don't sell Andres Gomez.
Not yet.
I think there. Well, some point, yes, definitely do. But the word that I got out of RSL was this summer is the time to add and not subtract. And Gomez has been on an epic heater, just an incredible heater. And he's going to be perhaps getting a look with Colombia, maybe not in Copa America, but he's been around that first team otherwise in friendlies leading up to it. Young player, thriving. Watch him closely in the windows to come. All right, Colorado, Minnesota. Another 3-3 game, man. Rocky Mountain Cup, they got it going on. Dane St. Clair played hero, saved the penalty kick on Navajo. And then this was a theme this weekend, gave up an epically soft goal. But really, the story of the game was two halves, Doyle. The first half, it was all Minnesota, and they were direct, and they were ruthless in those moments where they got turned, where they found the ball in midfield and had runners in behind. They just absolutely destroyed Colorado in those moments. But from open play, Colorado basically dominated the game. And afterwards, Eric Ramsey was pretty frustrated. He said, "It's one of those games that I will try to erase from my memory. We're not going to play in these conditions ever again. Quote, we really struggled with the ball today. That leads to us playing forward very quickly. Then we're not well connected to pick up second balls when they drop, and we give an awful lot of space away behind the back line when we've played forward. That led to a pretty ugly performance, I would say, and one that I would not like to produce again." So to read between the lines, there are like three perfect moments and everything else, booty.
Yeah, and it speaks to what idiots we are, because we're watching this happen, and we're like, oh, this is so brilliant from Minnesota. They're just playing long and playing for second balls every time, and they're annihilating that Colorado central midfield and turning every 50-50 into a transition opportunity. And look, man, it worked. It was not by design, but the first half, that was the story of it. And we saw, like, we looked in the data, and it was Minnesota won something like 70% of the loose balls in central midfield. Like, they were dominating on duels, and it looked like it was by design. And it looked like in the second half, Chris Armas probably just gave his team the hairdryer treatment, and they came out and they were much more competitive physically, and they matched that to playing some good soccer, and they came back for the 3-3 draw. But it turns out that no, none of it was by design, according to Eric Ramsey.
I think some of it was. Like, for instance, the goal that they score off of the, I think it's off of a goal kick from, was it in this game or a different game? I don't know. Basically, the goals where they score, where they win a second ball and get turned and go immediately behind the defense with Sang Bin, that is by design. The problem is none of the other things were ever by design. Completing 53 passes in the first half was definitely not by design. And this is where I have, and I threw up the contender sign on Minnesota in wrap up as well, and I was doing it mostly to play heel. But that's where I have my issues with this Minnesota team. They can't control the game with the ball. And they've been very good about turning games into the sort of game state that they want and taking advantage of those transition moments. Their press has been very good. Their defensive structure and compactness has been really good. They press and defend out of a 5-2-3, but they just can't control games with the ball, even with Robin Lud. So that's a big question mark for them going forward, is how do they just control the state of the game a little bit more? Not all of it. They're not going to be a 60% possession team, but not one where they're completing 53 passes in one half. All right, let's get some quick hits here. Charlotte 0, Philadelphia 0.
We got a shout out Ben Bellman, who is a big Rapids fan, who writes for American Soccer Analysis, does some podcasting as well. I promised him that if he gave us a tweet, well, a skeet actually, because this is off of Blue Sky, that we would read it.
It's called a skeet?
Yes.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Nearly all of Minnesota's first half offensive value came from the goal sequences. That's luck plus poor defense in key moments from Colorado, not efficiency on recoveries from Minnesota. The Loons conceded too much risk and got away with a lot. See the Cabral, they just barely dodged a Kevin Cabral hat trick. Even half at
I mean, but who hasn't? Me. Who hasn't just barely dodged a Kevin Cabral fill in the
blank? Right?
Like, that's like the state of Kevin Cabral. Everybody's dodging Kevin Cabral goals. It's like, a league average finisher should finish there, but it's Kevin Cabral, so he's not going to.
You know who else was dodging? Know who else was dodging a Kevin Cabral goal? Dane St. Clair. Anyway, continue.
That's a good point. I would say that Ben is almost universally correct here. I'm not sure that I would say that it's luck on those goals, the ball recovery and the moments they got. It's not luck that, you know, they did really well routing Colorado's possession into a central midfield area where they can both press and back press and then win the ball and go direct. That's not luck to me. It's not luck to me that you have seven or eight guys in a space where there's five Colorado players and you win all the second balls in a ping pong game and the ball falls to Robin Lode and he has a great turn and plays a good ball. Like, those are the attributes that you would expect those players to have when they have numerical advantage and it gets to Robin Lud. Now, is it luck that all the moments that they had that looked like that they scored on? Yeah, maybe that's good fortune. Maybe that's good fortune. But an even better performance by Colorado to come back is what I would say. To have gotten punched in the mouth in that way and then to come back that is a sign that what Chris Armas is building isn't just like, oh yeah, when we get a lead at home in altitude, we can usually choke other teams out and win that game. We've seen that before. It's, oh hey, we're down in a position last year where we would have straight up laid down. We came back swinging and probably should have won. We missed a penalty kick. That's a good sign for the Rapids. I just followed Ben. I don't know how I was not following Ben. If there is a analytics nerd that loves MLS out there and I'm not following you, please, please drop in my DMs. It is a personal error and nothing against you. Quick draw hits here. As I said, Charlotte 0, Philadelphia 0. That's five straight shutouts for Charlotte, Doyle. Five straight, man. But the big news around Philly is what we're going to talk about, which is that Julian Carranza could be on his way to Feyenoord in the summer. Bummer.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great landing spot for him. I feel like the Union kind of have to keep him and just he'll see out his contract for 2024, because if they want to win something, they need Julian Carranza. They're not winning anything with, I mean, they're probably not winning anything with him given the way they've played, but they're definitely not winning anything without him.
We'll see if it's in the summer or if it's on a free. I mean, I guess you would want to get a fee out of it for Julian Carranza, or maybe you just want to do right by him to get him his move when he wants it, since you're not going to re-sign him. I don't know. We'll see.
I mean, if he's willing to stay here, they should re-sign him at whatever the number is.
But I mean, we've been saying that for a while, but it doesn't seem like that's what he wants to do. And Jim Curtin actually addressed this. Jonathan Tannenwald had some good access an interview on this one about how Carranza would like to play in 2026 for Argentina. And that's a lofty dream. And I encourage him, but it's probably not going to happen for him in Philly. Probably has to go to Europe. We'll see. Montreal 0, Nashville 0. Yeah, I got nothing there.
Yep.
San Jose 1, Austin 1. You buying or selling Austin? Or are you holding?
I'm selling Austin. I think they've been playing better lately, but like San Jose was generating chance after chance after chance. I don't think you can keep getting results if you keep playing like this. But they are 6-2-2 in their past 10. So what do I know?
Yeah, I want to give huge credit to Josh Wolf and the coaching staff and all the players. They are, if you look at the numbers, low on just straight up players. Like, I don't think they're fielding a full bench in many games. And when you're playing in Austin the entire summer in those conditions where I want to say it's like 95 degrees already in the month of May. Yeah, that's going to be an issue. So shout out to those guys for finding a way. Sebastian Drewski coming back was good. That's whack. We just threw DC and Chicago in here, and we're going to use this to tee up this question from Josh Thompson. What big contracts should be jettisoned by teams to make room for new players? So we talked about Shaqiri. We'll see on Shaqiri. Enzo Capetti and Ragone have done their thing and exited left for us, so they've started the exodus. Who else would we throw in this category of possible big names, big contracts who could move on in the summer?
Well, it looks like Emmanuel Reynoso is just about gone. Club Tijuana is the reported interest there. And God, I'll miss watching that guy play in MLS. Georgios Giakoumakis, I mean, this is a tough one. If Atlanta were where they should be in the standings, I don't think there's any chance they would
not a chance
be selling. But they're, what, 12th in the East? And we just talked about half an hour ago how big a hill they have to climb. Giakoumakis is 29 and he's frequently injured, and that's not going to get better as he enters his 30s. So if Cruz Azul are going to offer you $9 or $10 million, it's tough for me to imagine saying no to that. That's not jettisoning, that's just like good business. Giacomo Vrioni, that would be a jettison deal.
Bupenza, well, I would think would be a most. I mean, unless you could find.
And look, I can't talk to a single plugged in person who thinks that Bupenza is ever going to play another game for Cincinnati. Sebastian Ferreira, they gave him another chance. They're not exactly flush with cap space. Like, they might have to hang on to him, but he's certainly someone who I wouldn't be shocked if he's gone. Timu Pukki has lost a starting job.
Do you think Pukki?
No, but like, he's someone we should mention, right? Victor Wanyama.
That's a good one.
If Nashville could figure out a way to create the cap space, he would help them a lot. Martin Ojeda, not a starter. It's his second year there. They need a playmaker. it's clear that Oscar Pereja doesn't rate him. Talis Magno, I know he's been hurt a lot, but even when he's been healthy, he hasn't appeared to ever win Nick Cushing's trust. Michael Ura is only a part-time starter for the Union.
I can understand that side of it. The thing with the Union is, are they going to go out and spend to replace
him? Right. Right.
So the answer to that, in my opinion, is almost certainly not.
Yep.
So I'd be thrilled to be surprised, but probably not. So I think he would say, how about Raul Ruiz Diaz?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, if the Sounders are rolling coming into mid-July and Ruiz Diaz is just okay. And
or what if they're not rolling? What if they're just sort of still where they're at right now, hanging around the playoff line, and there's an opportunity to go sign a guy because they like to make moves in the summer, the big ones at least, and they need a DP spot for it?
Yeah.
Goodbye, Raul out. Maybe Raul goes back to Mexico. Maybe he goes to Peru. Maybe he goes to a big South American club.
I think that's all on the table. I think if you were to ask me right now, I think that there's a better chance Ruiz Diaz doesn't finish 2024 with the Sounders than there is that he does finish 2024 in Rafe Green.
Yeah, all this is dependent on the market. We'll see what happens. But the transfer window doesn't open, I don't think, until July 15th or so in MLS. 18th. But, of course, 18th. The rumors will fly until then, and we'll talk about it as much as we can and fit it in. Let's talk about Wednesday real quick and then get on out of here because we do have midweek MLS. Game you're most excited to watch from the Wednesday slate. What do you got?
I think Sounders versus RSL. Specifically, for all those reasons we talked about, Seattle's been playing better. They've only lost once in their last six, and it was against this same RSL side. Now they have a chance to exact a little bit of revenge on them at home in Seattle. They're finally above the playoff line. Jordan Morris looked good, and we'll get to see De La Vega for half an hour in this one, I think. So because of all that, and then it's also a test of mettle for RSL. Right, like we both think they're for real. They're one of the top two or three teams in the Western Conference. We don't expect them to go away. They could make that case really clear by going out and getting 3 points on the road in this one.
Here's a critical moment: the next four games in the Supporters Shield race. It'll be two, and then of course with the international break, and then come back. But for RSL, three of their next four are on the road: at Seattle, at Montreal, at Kansas City, and then Austin at home. For Cincinnati and Miami, it's three out of four at home for both of those clubs. Miami, Atlanta, and St. Louis this week. Then you hit the international break at Philly, then Columbus at home. Nashville at home, at San Jose, Philly, New England for Cincinnati. So this is one of those moments where there's a four-point gap right now for RSL. If they want to stick around, they've got to get the job done on the road. The good news for RSL, they've been very, very good on the road so far. 3-1-4. If they can pick that up a little bit, maybe we got something cooking, but just one loss in eight games is pretty darn good. I'm watching Miami Atlanta, man. Come on. If there's an easy one that gets spoon fed to you, just open your mouth and swallow. Miami Atlanta is that game in Miami. We just saw the big three well rested, like Messi, Suarez, Busquets back in the lineup. Miami fighting for the shield. The rest of this team already in form on the other side. Atlanta under huge pressure. Just massive, massive pressure. And oh, wouldn't you know it, when you're under the most pressure, you got to go to Miami. And Bartosz Schlisch is listed out for this game due to personal reasons. So I'm pretty sure we're going to see a Dax McCarty sighting here. So that should be pretty fun. I will say this about Miami. I know we were talking about seven games straight with a win for Cincinnati. Had Miami not drew 0-0 against Orlando in Orlando, they would be on eight straight wins.
Yep.
So that's the type of form that we're talking about at the very top right now. I mean RSL
that is top tier analysis. They had eight straight wins, they would be on eight straight wins.
You're
that's
right.
Really
you're
well
completely
done.
Correct about that. Well done. You're picking up what I'm putting down, dude. RSL haven't lost since the 10th of March, and then New York City have one loss and seven wins in their last eight. So at the top of the standings right now, some really, really good results going on. That brings us to the biggest storyline that we're monitoring midweek. I'm going to be watching Philly-Toronto. Philly have lost four straight games at home. Four straight. That is completely out of the ordinary, out in the world of outliers I did not think I would see from this team. Meanwhile, Toronto go on the road, and they'll have both Italians. So will they be dressing Philly down? We'll see.
This is the second time since March, I think, that they've had both Italians starting.
It's been very rare.
Yeah. So well. Close to a full strength Toronto side. That's a good one. I think the storyline I'm keeping a closest eye on is that Cincinnati winning streak. Again, only one other team has in the post-shootout era, only one other team in MLS history has had an 8-game winning streak. It was the 2018 Sounders. They pushed it to 9, which is the record winning streak in MLS since he could claim second all on their own. Frankly, they should. They're hosting a Sounders or a Nashville team that is not great right now. I'm definitely keeping an eye on that one.
How about the after dark, the midweek game that's just going to be silly in the best way?
I got to look at the schedule now. I was not prepared for that question.
Oh, I was trying to tee you up on the one you wrote down, but
what did I write down?
Montreal, DC.
Is that after dark?
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably before dark. There's probably half that game played in the dark.
That is like that game literally starts before nightfall.
Fine. I'll do like you look. You can make a sell on that one being after dark when the lights are still on, but I'm going to give Austin FC Portland a shout on this one. Austin are fun at home. Like they want to have the ball, they want to attack. They're much more pragmatic on the road. Plus Driussi is back and he always just seems to bathe in the green lights there in Austin. And then Timbers, man, they score goals. Their DPs have the third best production in the league this year.
Mm-hmm.
But they give up so many goals. They just give up goals. So this one to me has got like 3-2 written all over it.
I'll say for my after dark choice, I'm going to say LAFC hosting Minnesota, two of the top four teams in the Western Conference standings right now. I think that LAFC are, over the past month and a half, they've climbed back into that tier with Columbus, Cincinnati, and Miami. And I think RSL are there as well. By the underlying numbers, they're the best team in the league, LAFC are. And this is a type of game that if you're the best team in the league or among them, you win. Even though Minnesota's been really good at collecting results, you win this game. Should be noted, though, both Ilie and Eddie Atuesta are probably out for this one. So it could be very sort of 3-4-3 direct transition, whereas most of this good recent run from LAFC has come out of their newfound ability to create tempo and use the ball through midfield.
Right now, Minnesota maybe the best team in the league on the road, 4-1-1, and LAFC haven't lost at home. 5 wins, 2 draws. We'll see how this one plays out, but it sure feels like after the Loons couldn't do Jack Diddley with the ball that LAFC will say, we're going to make you try, and when you can't, we're going to run it down the other way. All right, let's end here. Mailbag. Team Concha hit us up, said, all we see are players in Europe getting standing ovations as they leave a club. So what the heck is happening with Carlos Vela and LAFC? This gives me Gio Dos Santos or Josie Altidore vibes. What he did for LAFC in the league seems to not have been respected as it should have. I'm not sure I agree with the respected as it should have part. I think there was just a thought that they would find a solution to bring him back that wouldn't be a designated player spot in all likelihood. And Carlos was like, I'm good, dog. Like, I could take it or leave it. Like, I mean, this is what it's going to take. And if you don't check that box, I'm not going to come back. And LAFC were sort of like, well, we can't in good conscience, given the way we want to build our roster, give you the spot. Maybe something happens in the summer when the rules change, we assume, and you can use all of your U22 spots in addition to having 3 senior DPs. But until then, it just sort of feels like two sides that just are like, well, this is the terms and I can't really change what those terms are.
I think that's exactly correct.
Good discussion. Well, it turns out if you win 7 games in a row, that's 7 straight wins. And if you draw in the middle of 8, that's not 8 straight wins. The more you learn, the more you listen to Extra Time. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with us here as we wrapped up Match Day 16 and lead you into Match Day 17. Enjoy Wednesday night. 6:30 p.m. Eastern, MLS Countdown on MLS Season Pass, then MLS 360 and all the games. And, of course, we'll be back with the wrap-up at 12:30 Eastern. You can listen, watch, however you consume that on Thursday morning, and we'll be back Thursday afternoon to lead you into the CONCACAF Champions Cup final as well as Match Day 18. Doyle, thanks for your time. To everyone listening, have a great week. Adios.